It's important that the United States reinforce the fact that we are quite committed to the South Korean security.
The U.S. Defense Secretary reaffirms support of South Korea. It's Wednesday, February 1st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us right now on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a UN message sparks a social media response in China. A human rights group slams Philippines' drug war. Indonesia addresses refugees and asylum seekers. Lunar New Year celebrations in Cambodia. Stay with us as VOA Asia starts now. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis, ahead of his first foreign trip, has spoken with his South Korean counterpart, Hanmin Koo, about what the Pentagon called a reaffirmation of the U.S. commitment to defend Seoul and provide extended deterrence using the full range of U.S. capabilities. Mattis is to visit South Korea Thursday and Friday before departing for Japan. North Korea's growing nuclear and missile threat and deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, anti-missile system are expected to be high on the agenda. The deployment is opposed by China. There are also reports the North is restarting operation of a nuclear reactor capable of producing weapons-grade plutonium. RAND Corporation Korea analyst Bruce Bennett tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's important South Korea and the United States remain united against the threat by Pyongyang.
North Korea is pushing the notion of an ICBM because it's trying to decouple the United States and South Korea. It's trying to say, South Korea, you can no longer count on the U.S. because we can target American cities, and so the U.S. won't trade Los Angeles or Seattle for Seoul. And so it's important that the United States reinforce the fact that we are quite committed to the South Korean security, and not just to preventing nuclear weapon use, but also to trying to roll back or at least rein in the nuclear weapon program in the North.
Is there anything else the U.S. can do aside from the deployment of this THAAD anti-missile system?
THAAD doesn't deal with an ICBM. It doesn't help with the particular threat Kim Jong-un has been making. It does help with any missiles that would be fired at the southern half of South Korea. That's what it's intended to cover. If North Korea decides to launch an ICBM, the United States has a couple of possibilities for intercepting it. Former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter just a couple of weeks ago said, if North Korea launches a missile that goes in the direction of the U.S., we probably ought to intercept it. Well, we don't know if a missile is going to have a nuclear weapon on it, so we probably ought to intercept it wherever it goes, because it could shoot down an airplane, destroy ships on the surface. We have to be prepared to defend, and we have interceptors in Alaska that could be used for that purpose.
Any idea how close North Korea is to another nuclear or missile test?
I would have to guess that unless Kim Jong-un is absolutely desperate for internal political purposes, he would prefer to postpone such a test until after the South Korean presidential election, which is no more than July away from now. He doesn't want to do a test and make it threatening to the South Korean people and perhaps throw the balance of the election to the South Korean conservatives. Since the whole problem with President Park came up, he hasn't done any tests, either missiles or nuclear, and probably will continue that unless, as I say, he's feeling desperate for internal purposes to have to prove to his elites that he's still powerful.
Bruce Bennett says while the Trump administration appears to be treating the threat by the Islamic State as a national security threat number one, the Mattis trip to South Korea and Japan appears to signal that North Korea is seen as the second largest threat to U.S. security. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. Amnesty International says Philippine police killings possible crime against humanity. Ambassador says United States not building arms depot in Philippines. At funeral of slain Myanmar lawyer, many fear threat to reform. Asia targets tourism, education boost from Trump travel ban. A record 32.59 million foreign tourists visit Thailand in 2016. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more is found on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Social media users in China have had much to discuss during the Lunar New Year celebrations. One topic, though, was unexpected, both by Chinese netizens and the organization that made the initial posts. VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ai joins us by telephone to fill us in on the uproar over a United Nations call to help people in need.
You know, China's Weibo is it's the Wild West. There's a lot of things that are going on every day, a lot of issues that really attract people's attention. And over the weekend, I noticed that we had two posts from the UN that were getting a lot of attention. One was a video that was basically to try to get people to think about the plight of refugees. And so it's a split screen video that is about a couple minutes long and has scenes of course, conflict zones, refugee camps, contrast with people, you know, living happy lives and going about their day-to-day lives in other parts of the world. And the other was a picture of a malnourished child from Africa, and it was talking, the message was that for people as they were enjoying their lunar feast to think about the fact that there are others in this world that are starving every day, and it also was a call to help the UN, help it reach its the Sustainable Development Goal of eradicating poverty by 2030. The messages were pretty standard fare for the UN. And in the United States, around the holidays, we see these kinds of messages. But people really took it the wrong way, or they took it in a different way. They were very upset about it. In terms of refugees, there were a lot of comments, a lot of swearing and other things, but, you know, basically blaming the United States and other Western countries for the refugee crisis and saying this has nothing to do with China, and then talking about poverty. These are all problems that other countries have created. Why are you talking to us about this while we're celebrating our holiday?
Neither of the posts suggested that China was to blame for any of the refugee crisis or the problems that they were outlining in these ads. I understand that many Chinese argued the United States and the West were the ones who should be receiving such messages on Facebook during the holidays, when, in fact, we do.
Yes, the United States does. Other parts of the world, this is what the United Nations does. I mean, it's part of kind of you know, good PR. You're trying to get people interested in these issues. You're trying to get them engaged and contributing money or, you know, volunteering to help out in some way or whatnot. And this is just a way of creating awareness. To me, that's kind of shows, you know, where we are at here in China. And, you know, when it comes to poverty, in 2015, when Xi Jinping went to the UN to speak, he announced that China was going to be putting forth this large amount of money to help out with poverty and alleviate debt in certain countries. And there was a backlash here in China. And the reason for that is that while many people have been able to raise themselves out of poverty here over the past few decades with China's economic rise, there are still a lot of people that live in poverty. And so people feel there's kind of this conflict here that, you know, you want to play a bigger role on the global stage, but at the same time, there are problems at home that need addressing too. And some people feel that should have a bigger priority. And that's a question that it'll continue to grapple with. But I felt was kind of something, you know, kind of hidden deeper inside this whole kerfuffle over the UN's Weibo account.
Bill, we greatly appreciate your charitable donation of your time to explain this to us. Bill Ide, our Beijing correspondent, thank you.
No problem. Glad to speak with you.
Happening now in Asia, India has unveiled a radical proposal to eliminate poverty. Stressing this is only a concept, the idea was floated in the country's just-released annual economic survey that says guaranteeing a universal basic income to cover every individual's basic needs would promote social justice. Stay up to date with VOA. We're happier with us today on VOA Asia. Amnesty International claims the Philippine government has ordered the police to kill thousands of alleged drug offenders in a wave of executions that may amount to crimes against humanity. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte this week ordered all police anti-drug units to be disbanded in the wake of the killing of a South Korean man, allegedly by corrupt officers.
The scale of Amnesty's accusations is shocking. The group claims up to 7,000 people have been killed in the last 7 months since President Rodrigo Duterte took office. Tirana Hassan is Amnesty's crisis response director.
The government at the highest levels have ordered the police and police working in concert with armed hitmen who are essentially acting as hit squads and executing people.
Amnesty says the police often act with no evidence and target the poorest sections of Philippine society.
What we've found is police are being paid for individual hits. They're working in cahoots with the actual funeral homes, where they're being paid on each body that they deliver to the funeral homes. We've seen police who have planted evidence to actually cover up extrajudicial executions.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has made the war on drugs a central tenet of his leadership, even claiming in December that he personally killed suspected criminals when he was mayor of Davao City. But this week, Duterte ordered all police anti-drug units disbanded following the killing of a South Korean businessman by corrupt officers allegedly involved in a kidnapping ring. But in a news conference Monday, he said the war on drugs would go on.
The drug war, I will extend it to the last day of my term.
The Philippine government has yet to respond directly to Amnesty's report. President Duterte has repeatedly said he was elected on a mandate to eliminate illegal drugs. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Organizers for next month's Asian Winter Games in Japan say a book calling the Nanjing Massacre a fabrication, and it will be removed from guest rooms at hotel housing athletes. It's a condition the hotel agreed to last year. Only materials needed for the games are permitted to ensure neutrality. This and other news stories on today's Asia in a Minute with Steve Miller on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia continues. The White House on Tuesday mounted a blunt defense of President Donald Trump's decision to fire the nation's top prosecutor, calling acting Attorney General Sally Yates' refusal to enforce an executive order limiting travel from seven mostly Muslim countries bewildering and defiant. He also called on Democratic lawmakers in the Senate to quit their obstruction and confirm Senator Jeff Sessions as the next Attorney General and to approve other Trump cabinet nominees under Senate consideration. Earlier Tuesday, Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly also defended Trump's executive order, which suspends entry to all refugees for 120 days and bans Syrian refugees indefinitely. It also blocks people from Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia from entering the United States for 3 months. Officials say 872 refugees will be admitted to the country because of hardship concerns, despite the presidential order. Indonesia, meanwhile, also has taken a stance on refugees and asylum seekers. President Joko Widodo recently signed a presidential decree that affects roughly 14,000 refugees and asylum seekers already in the country. VOA Asia's Steve Miller finds out more with reporter Krithika Varagor in Jakarta.
He finally released a decree right around the holidays at the end of December that addresses the status of all the refugees and asylum seekers in Indonesia, and there are about 14,000 of them. And the reason this is a big deal is because before this, refugees and asylum seekers were totally ignored in Indonesian law. And also Indonesia is not a signatory to the UN Convention on Refugees. So basically, refugees were persona non grata in Indonesia until last month.
What's the rationale behind this? Because weren't there already some provisions already in place?
Yeah. So discussions about the need for a decree like this have been going on since at least 2010 under the previous president, Yudhoyono. But the reason it's come back to the forefront is that President Widodo has taken a special interest in the Rohingya refugee crisis of Muslims who are being persecuted in Myanmar, who are from Bangladesh originally. And a lot of Rohingyas have come to Indonesia, and in Myanmar is a neighboring Southeast Asian country, and President Widodo has taken a keen interest in this. So that's helped speed it along. And a lot of people are saying this is a good first step for Indonesia to better address its refugee population.
Now, the Rohingya population in Myanmar and in Bangladesh, they are a group that several rights groups have said that their human rights have been violated. If we take a look at what's happening in the Rakhine State, there are allegations of rape, of murder, of houses being burnt down. Does the new decree protect their human rights when entering Indonesia?
No, it doesn't go so far as to protect any specific group. What it does is just recognizes that the ones who are already in Indonesia exist, and that NGOs and government bodies can treat them, and they're not illegal immigrants. It doesn't go out of its way to address any particular group, including the Rohingya.
Catherine Gavargor is our reporter in Indonesia. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Your thoughts and comments are important and always welcome on our Facebook page. Check out VOA Asia and like us while you're there. Developing at this hour in Asia, Jakarta says it will block a rally by the Islamic Defenders Front next month ahead of the election for city governor. The group accuses Governor Purnama of insulting the Quran. Police say the end of the campaign period should not be disrupted by protests. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, we continue our celebration of the Year of the Rooster as we hear from our VOA correspondents who cover Asia. Khmer reporter Risi Poach joins us for some of the traditions at this time of the year in Cambodia.
Cambodia celebrates three New Years, January 1st, and then the Lunar New Year, and then Cambodian New Year, which is in April. So we are actually doing the second of the third.
That's special because most people are just celebrating two. You get three. Now, what is the third Cambodian New Year?
Well, traditionally, Cambodians celebrate with Burma, Bangladesh, I think Laos, Thailand. Mm-hmm. They all celebrate the same New Year in April.
Okay.
Yeah, it was picked for April. It's almost like Thanksgiving. Harvest was done before the next planting season comes. They find that time is a good time to celebrate the New Year.
Makes sense. So tell me about some of the things that you're doing for this Lunar New Year. Well, what are some of the ways you celebrate?
Yeah, on the New Year's Eve, we all put offerings to the ancestors. We put rice and roast duck and all kind of, you know, good, delicious food for New Year. And then on New Year's Day, the first day, we celebrate the main. It's actually 2 weeks, but mm-hmm. but for us, we don't have the time. So this year, we're lucky. It falls on the weekend. So the first day, you would visit friends and families the first day, and you try not to sweep the house, clean the house, because it means you take away the good luck.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you clean the house before New Year. You do it on New Year's Eve. So on New Year's Day, you don't want to touch anything. And you want to leave rice in the pot to show that you have abundant of rice. You don't want to finish up. You don't want to clean up your food.
Right.
And then we give red envelopes, whether you're in Cambodia or in America. It's a tradition to give red envelopes for good luck.
That's a good tradition because I know there's money.
Yes, that's the whole point. It can be more or can be less, but sometimes people don't spend the money in the red envelope. They keep it for the whole year for good luck.
Good luck, yeah. You're starting off the good year with an abundance and with a clean home that you just kind of leave the way it is and then keep the money for good luck.
Yep.
In modern times, people have to work and that kind of cuts into the whole two-week celebration, but I guess still goes on, right, in the evenings perhaps throughout the week?
Yeah, the celebration is not as obvious, mm-hmm. but people are in the mood. It's New Year's, and the other thing that they try to do during the New Year is that they don't use bad words, they don't cuss, and mm-hmm. try to be polite and, you know, like Thanksgiving. I keep comparing with Thanksgiving because you're nice to each other.
Right. That is a very good thing to do. We're so happy that we're starting off the new year with you. And when we have another new year, we'll have you back. How about that?
That's great. That sounds great, Jim. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Reese. And as we mentioned, New Year's can be rather short or last a long time at this time of the year. However you celebrate it, we hope your New Year is going very well. We'll have a couple more perspectives of the Lunar New Year as the week progresses from other parts of Asia, so be sure to come back and check it out. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We always invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, VOA Asia. A lot of great stuff on there that you'll want to check out. And we also like to acknowledge all of our listeners in Myanmar listening to VOA Burmese Facebook. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're always happy to have you with us. You can find us at our website too, voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Nelson Lopes. Our managing editor, Diane Gao. And always a great thanks to our great VOA Asia team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, Eli Zimmerman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been nearly 22 years since the signing of the Dayton Agreement ended the Bosnian conflict. But to this day, ultranationalists within the multi-ethnic country of Bosnia and Herzegovina are attempting to sow hatred, spark strife among neighbors, fracture the country along ethnic lines, and push agendas that prioritize their ethnic group at the expense of stability and prosperity for the country as a whole. As stipulated by the Dayton Agreement, Bosnia and Herzegovina is a single sovereign state comprised of two entities, the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Republika Srpska. The Dayton Agreement also established the office of the High Representative to ensure the implementation of the agreement. In 1997, the international community granted the High Representative special legal authorities, also known as the Bonn powers, to assure that Bosnia and Herzegovina's political entities comply with and fully implement the peace agreement. In September 2016, President of Republika Srpska Milorad Dodik held a referendum to designate January 9th as Republika Srpska Day. And on January 9th, Dodik led the celebration of Republika Srpska Day. Both the referendum and the holiday itself had been banned by the country's constitutional court, which found the holiday discriminatory against non-Serbs living in Republika Srpska. For his role in defying the constitutional court of Bosnia and Herzegovina in violation of the rule of law, thereby actively obstructing the Dayton Accords, and for conduct that poses a significant risk of actively obstructing the peace agreement, the United States Treasury Department has sanctioned Milorad Dodik. This means that any property or interest in property Mr. Dodik has within United States jurisdiction is blocked, and U.S. persons may not engage in transactions with him. The United States strongly opposes challenges to the Dayton Agreement and rhetoric that advocates secession for the Republika Srpska.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.